We wanted to confront the students with this new sort of, you know, geometry, which, you know, they could just go out and explore. And we did that even with the bookworm. A project like the bookworm, you know, hasn't been sort of realized before. And we were absolutely overjoyed to see the reception that it received through the eyes of the students, because that's the real test, you know, how do people actually explore these spaces in the real world.
Welcome to the Design Pataki podcast, a show that deconstructs the Indian and international design world with leading industry experts. I'm Isha Gupta, the founder of Design Pataki. Architect Nuru Kareem is the founder of Nudes, a Mumbai-based firm that operates within the realm of architecture, art, and computational design. He received his master's in architecture and urbanism from the Architectural Association in London in 2006. Prior to helming his own architectural practice, he had worked for Zaha Hadid Architects on a host of institutional projects. Nuru Kareem has achieved global critical recognition for his work, as well as several design awards, including a nomination for the Aga Khan Award for Architecture. He is also a TEDx speaker and has presented his work and research on national and international platforms. Hi Nuru, thank you so much for joining us in the Design Pataki podcast. I'm so excited to talk to you about the parametric architecture, especially in the Indian context. My first question to you is going to be, how do you define parametric design?
Hi, Isha and team, and it's wonderful to be here. Thank you for inviting me. It's a very complex question, and I'll probably try to answer this as simply as possible. But parametric design is about setting relations between different elements or parameters. And that actually defines a range of alternates that allow greater control in the hands of the designer, right? So let me give you a simple example. If you actually look at a simple geometry or like an element like a circle, how would you define the form of a circle, right? So you would perhaps define it based on its area, radius, diameter, so on and so forth. But if you actually were to visualize the parametric form of that circle, it would be closer to a Ferris wheel, right? So the parametric form of the circle would then be defined by a bunch of parametric equations, a set of streaming values, a circle that's perhaps in constant motion, defined by time. Time is a very important sort of parameter in parametric design. And you have directionality and vectors. The first instance of parametric design goes back to the 1960s, right? So it might seem like it's new turf now, but it goes back, you know, almost six decades ago. And there was this very interesting project by Luigi Moretti, who designed a stadium based on 19 design parameters. And some of these parameters were simple parameters like sight lines, including the computation of the quantum of concrete. So this dates back in 1960. There have also been traditional sort of examples of analog computing through the work of Gaudi, right? So I'm sure you heard of Gaudi.
Of course.
The Sagrada Familia, one of his greatest creations that's under construction. But he worked on this very interesting suspension chain model, and he was able to test forces through a simple system using analog computing. So Gaudi worked on basically three parameters. There was the length of the string, an anchor point, and a per shot weight. And of course, you had recent advancements in computer design, computation. Even Sutherland's sketchpad in the 60s pioneered human-computer interaction. So since then, there've been quantum strides, you know, where digital computing is concerned. And it has also extended into the sort of dialogue of parametric design and the role of fabrication and construction as well.
And what drew you to parametric design as opposed, or parametric architecture as opposed to the traditional forms of design?
So it's been a very natural sort of evolution, you know. It hasn't happened overnight. It's been a very long sort of journey spanning almost, 15-20 years. And it has been a natural evolution in my interest in architecture, technology, nature. And of course, with time, technology changes, there are new tools. And I was always very thirsty to sort of immerse myself into exploring these new tools, these new ideologies, which explore the intersection of, art, architecture, nature, and technology. So that's how the sort of interest and the love for this sort of tool grew over a period of time.
Would you say that parametric design breaks the conventional rules of architecture?
So let's sort of address this through a timeline in history, right? So one way is to dissect a timeline in history across the ages. And, each age was sort of marked with a certain evolution in technology, right? So we had the Stone Age, we had the Bronze Age, we had the Iron Age. We had the Industrial Revolution, and the Industrial Revolution produced tools to augment the body, right? So we had the steam engine, we had the automobiles that could actually transport goods and humans across the world in pretty quick time. The fourth Industrial Revolution is the Digital Revolution, and that really, in a way, sort of extends the intellect or focuses on tools that extend the human intellect. And this sort of digital revolution has opened up several doors, several avenues for exploring cutting-edge design tools and exploring future collaborations across sectors. So I wouldn't actually extend the argument in terms of, whether it's traditional or it's advanced. But see this as sort of opportunities to perhaps subvert these conventional rules and open up possibilities of design and innovation in the zeitgeist in current times.
And, going back to when you sort of started working as well, I believe you spent a lot of time at Zahadid Architects, and, they're considered as pioneers in bringing parametric design into mainstream. So how has that influenced what you do today?
Yeah, so, starting at the Architectural Association in London, where I did my master's, and that was an absolutely incredible experience. And, you will find a lot of graduates, postgraduates working at ZHA. And, of course, the firm actually empowers you to actually stretch the design of limits or stretch the limits of design and imagination. So it's amazing that, ZHA, including other, leading firms across the world, are designing buildings and actually constructing these buildings across the globe. So in its formative years, ZHA was basically a small studio of about 8 to 10 people, right? And now it's grown to incredible global stature, one of the leading firms in the world. And it's grown from a very humble 8-10 odd design firm to about 300-400 people. And for me, this is a great story. It's a great story and a great source of inspiration about pursuing your ideals, ideologies, come what may. And my key takeaways were patience, perseverance, and hard work. So these become the sort of driving parameters in a way to move towards achieving your goals and your dreams.
So let's talk about parametric design closer to home in the Indian context. What are the characteristics which are specific to Indian architecture that you've noticed?
So, firstly, I think, the whole idea of the incorporation of parametric tools is not region or country specific. There have been several sort of associations of parametric design with a certain visual language, right? So people sometimes understand parametric tools as seeing something which is free-form or sinuous or extremely complex, but that couldn't be further from the truth because we're looking at parametric tools and not necessarily a parametric style, right? So I personally believe, reducing architectural languages to styles is extremely dangerous. And they really don't address the true meaning and value, where the investigation of that language is concerned. And I get that all the time, you know, that, you know, someone looks at a certain project and says, this is a parametric style. But no, I think we're talking about tools. We're not looking at a style. We're not trying to label a certain a form, which is necessarily complex or sinuous or it's curvilinear or fluid. But I think there are several opportunities for designers in the country to contextualize Indian architecture and truly innovate. And that innovation really happens when you start respecting, you know, Indian tradition, the aspect of place, culture, people and context. So I think that becomes sort of extremely fundamental to exploring how you could use parametric tools in the Indian context, rather than look at a new sort of paradigm that explores Indian parametric architecture, the latter being a little dangerous where I'm concerned.
You know, you speak about parametric tools. Let's talk about robotics and 3D printing, which is used. You know, the cost that's attached to it. Do you feel like that's been a challenge while designing or in your practice as well?
So like any sort of technology, you know, when it's recently launched, you know, the cost of prohibitive, you know, the cost of what a phone was when it came in, you know, the cost of a computer that actually came in. And what's happened with technology is that, it has actually scaled up tremendously. In this case, when you look at technology such as 3D printing, and even 3D printing is sort of archaic now, we're looking at 4D printing. But when you look at technologies like 3D printing, I don't think there's any other technology on the planet has sort of scaled up enormously and the costs have come down, right? When I say scaled up is when you can actually print, a small sort of, you know, object that you can keep on your table to actually printing a furniture piece or even printing an entire house. So I think that scale has increased tremendously and the cost has really come down. I remember when I was a student at the Architectural Association, the cost of a small model, which we 3D printed, which is about 1 foot by 1 foot by 1 foot, 1 cubic feet, cost about 1,500 quid. And in today's age and time, you can actually print that at about 10 or 15 quid. So it's dramatically gone down. It's also a very democratic way of producing objects and allowing these tools to come in the hands of the end consumers. And I have very little doubt that, you know, projects in the future will be printed. They will not be constructed. So there's tremendous sort of potential. One of the great aspects about 3D printing is it has zero waste, right? So everything that you pump in through the nozzle of a printer, of a 3D printer, gets used. There is absolutely zero waste. Of course, the cost of the printer is prohibitive at this time. But if you look at economies of scale, and if you were to build, 100 houses instead of one house, then the cost actually comes down. So there are opportunities, and we are really at the crossroad of a very exciting time where technology is concerned.
So it's demand and supply related, and as you said, economies of scale. Does that also answer a question where parametric design could be used for low-cost housing per se as well?
Yes, absolutely. I think we could use parametrics for low-cost housing. In fact, we are already in discussions with some stakeholders and to see how we could get the funding for this, and do these projects in India. But yes, it's something that is very dear to my heart that, I truly believe that we should focus on design for everyone, not for the 1 or 1.5% or the percentage that can actually afford these cutting edge tools, but even for marginalized societies, for societies that really don't have access to, food or quality health or quality housing or sanitation or water supply. So I think the idea is definitely to achieve a sort of a critical mass and not confine technology merely in the hands of a few privileged folks. But that is the aim. I would love to do a low-cost housing project. Let me know if you can collaborate on that.
Done. Sounds like a plan. You know, you spoke about zero waste. And what is your opinion on, you know, sustainability and, again, parametric design? Do they go hand in hand? What are the pros? What are the cons that you've noticed?
So, you know, when we look at, you know, these sort of economies, there are three economies that come to my mind. One is the waste economy, right? So when we look at industries and the amount of waste that industries produce, you know, most of it goes into waste, right? So there's a great amount of industrial waste, right? That's the waste economy. And surprisingly enough, that is even prevalent today across the world. The second economy is the reuse economy. And we are looking at the reuse economy as recycling, right? And so what it means is that if you have the industrial wastes are actually going to be reused and recycled. But even if, you know, all the nations across the globe were to commit to, you know, fulfill their commitments in terms of reducing the carbon footprint, we would still be in debt where nature is concerned. In 2050, still, you know, we would sort of lose this race against time. And about a billion people would still be displaced because of climate change in many, many ways. So I think just reuse and recycling is not enough, which really brings about the question of circular economies, which is what the world is currently looking at. Is reusing the waste in the design process itself, or looking at design processes that have zero waste. So sustainability, in my mind, is no longer an option. It is critical to our survival. And we have to look at definitions beyond sustainability, such as the definition of you know, circular economy and how we can actually produce this whole cradle-to-cradle philosophy.
And, you know, your work, you've implemented these philosophies in your work as well. So do you want to talk about your project in Malawi or the Cardboard Cafe or, you know, the other projects where you've done, where you've, you know, really use these theories as well?
So, you know, I firmly believe that the role of technology and sustainable initiatives are very crucial in addressing climate change and renewable energy resources. You know, so for example, we're currently working on this project called the Solar Mountain, which is going to be part of the Burning Man project at the Fly Ranch property in Nevada. And that actually, you know, uses solar energy, but is also built out of timber, which is a renewable source of energy. So sometimes our decision, well, most of the time, our decision on selection of material comes at the conception stage. We really don't use materiality as a candy wrapping element to beautify a space or to use it as a sort of a decorative veneer. But it's driven by material performance rather than material appearance.
But how do you explore the materials as well? Because there are a lot of technicalities. I know you've used, like I mentioned before, cardboard and now straw bales. How do you develop that freedom with the different materials?
So cardboard was quite an interesting sort of project because we actually were researching on that material for almost 9 months to 12 months before we actually had a client on board. And once a client came on board, and this was in BKC, right? Very, very expensive prime property, very high rental rates, and stringent codes. You know, we sort of explained the project to them, showed them some prototypes, and they were sort of, they were not completely bought in, but we sort of demonstrated that even if you threw oil on it or you threw sauce on it, it wouldn't really affect the material. Plus, the sort of impact that, you know, you could have on addressing these issues or building sort of formidable strategies for, you know, this sort of social awareness or awareness where, you know, preserving the climate's resources is concerned. But I always sort of give my clients all the credit, you know. You know, I mean, it's this true sort of patronage that makes working all these projects, such a memorable sort of experience. But cardboard just fitted the bill. You know, it's amazing. It's cardboard, corrugated cardboard, in fact, 50% air, a great acoustic material, has so many wonderful sort of properties, can be shaped, molded, you know, digitally fabricated, assembled in quick time, lightweight, very strong. It was quite a satisfying sort of project. But again, the decision came because of the performance, not because what it looked like. And we tested the performance of this material in many scales. You know, we manufactured lights from it. We created tables from them. We created chairs from them, bar stools, bar tables, accessories, even details like where you can actually, put in your credit card or take your bill or leave the change, menu cards, all of that. So it's very, very sort of holistic design that we wanted to look at. And we didn't want to fake it. We didn't want to sort of reinforce the strength of cardboard with, you know, steel or with wood or with some other sort of plywood material. So everything that you see is made out of paper. I remember we did some tests with the cardboard chair. We were not very impressed with the structural performance, and then we sort of reinforced them with paper tubes. So even the detail was such that, you know, we started looking for a material that could perhaps match each other, you know, paper to paper rather than metal to cardboard. So we try to be very true and honest, you know, where the process is concerned here. Yeah.
Also, could you tell us about, you know, the Malawi project where you're using straw bales for a school project?
Yeah, so, you know, my first sort of reaction was when we started working on this, and said, what do we do with this? Because there was a lot of, you know, dry hay and straw, you know, in neighboring territories because of the very strong sort of climate, and you don't get a lot of grass that grows there. And my first reaction was, well, my God, what happens if this thing catches fire, you know? And we then started doing research on straw bale technology, and there was some very interesting sort of scientific documentation on that as to how straw bale can be used as a very, very sophisticated engineered material that could pass even fire codes across the world, and fire codes as stringent as even in developed nations in the West. And that sort of gave us the sort of confidence of how we could use this sort of technology. So it depends on the level of compaction. When you're working with straw bales, they can't be loose straw bales because it allows oxygen to pass through the density. So it has to be very, very dense. The minimum the porosity in the compacted straw bale, the better. That otherwise, you know, air and oxygen becomes fuel for fire in a way. And there are other ways you can actually, in certain applications we've seen, you could even plaster this with mud, and it serves as an insulation member as well. So, yeah, these were some sort of very interesting sort of tests that we wanted to work with. But our singular goal or the raison d'etre of the project was also we wanted to relook at, you know, traditional forms of African architecture and see how we could actually address this potential shift in paradigm. Rather than using the architecture of the past or traditional architecture and just sort of replicating it in a new avatar, you know, so to speak. So we wanted to just see how we could use certain sort of archetypes that one could be associated with traditional African architecture, and how we could actually sort of use this in a very innovative manner, given the context of the school. And for us, it was also important to address the school as a space for performance, as a space for dialogue, as a space for self-learning, as a space for growth, you know, as a space where students can actually interact, have fun. It becomes a sort of playscape. It's a soft, you know, cuddly sort of teddy bear you could go and sort of hug or sit on. And not this intimidating sort of, you know, massive monolith which sort of intimidates a lot of, you know, children, you know, with, you know, massive columns and triple height spaces and structures. But we wanted to confront the students with this new sort of, you know, geometry, which, you know, they could just go out and explore. And we did that even with the bookworm, you know. A project like the bookworm, you know, hasn't been sort of realized before. And we were absolutely overjoyed to see the reception that it received through the eyes of the students, because that's the real test. You know, how do people actually explore these spaces in the real world? You know, you might have the best intention as a designer, but when you put it out there, is that a success or a failure? And for us, it doesn't matter what sort of level it reaches in terms of personal gratification, in terms of innovation or language or tools or other aspects of space and time, but as to how people actually respond to that project. And it was amazing. Like, even the bookworm, you know, people were actually crawling up, kids were moving up and down. There were so many sort of, you know, wonderful experiences that were shared about how they actually used this. And kids just warmed up to it. You know, I saw just kids running over it, going under it, taking art, reading a book. And I was so happy, because the whole point was to, you know, ditch this digital interface for a while. You know, we sort of sit around these social tables, each of our heads buried behind these phones or iPads, not connecting with each other across the table, but connecting with someone else across the world. It's a very sad sort of narrative of our times. And we wanted people to go and just pick a book and read it, the tactile sensation of reading a book. So for us, these sort of things are the real perks and the real sort of rewards through a very stringent sort of design process.
This experience behind, you know, the experience of using that bookworm, which I think excites everyone, right? And I think it's a location, everything. I think it's fabulous, the place. It's at the Prince of Wales Museum, right?
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
So
because it's meant to be in fair weather. So, you know, it's meant to be an outdoor reading scape. And then it can pitch up. But our whole idea was that it travels across India. I would love the bookworm to actually travel to rural India, or perhaps even in the slums, you know, where, you know, kids can read and pick up a book. And it doesn't matter what language. It doesn't have to be English. It can be any regional language. So that was the real sort of idea behind the bookworm, to spread the love of reading across the nation, irrespective of social strata or irrespective of geographic location. It could be in a very remote area. It could be in an area that, you know, you might have to, like, you know, change 10 buses and maybe cycle 300, you know, meters to get there. That was the idea, that it needed to spread across.
Can you take us through your architectural process when you start a new project? How, I mean, I know this is a very vague question, but, you know, for young designers, architects listening, how do you usually approach a new project?
So I think, you know, of course, there are many, many ways we enter a project, right? And our work is sort of define our work at the intersection of art, architecture, and design, right? So we're working on public art installations, but also architectural projects, urban design projects, furniture, product design, so on and so forth. So for us, there's tremendous cross-learning across these platforms. And if you actually were to have a sort of a symposium and you were to put in, you know, panelists from all these different industries, they would probably present a very different sort of, you know, process, you know, very intrinsic to their industry or to the modes of production. So for us, it's a real big jump into the unknown. You know, it's even when we're doing a competition, I always tell my team, you know, let's play to lose. You know, let's not play to the gallery. Let's be true and honest to ourselves. Let's see really what we want to achieve for this process. And let's not think about, oh yeah, we need another project. And to be honest, every time, you know, and I learned this the hard way, because I played at the gallery about 1 or 2% in my entire life, and that 1 or 2% I've lost, you know. So that was a great sort of eye opener for us in our design studio, that we must sort of push our limits and get that sort of satisfaction up front. The thing that I sort of learned from working on art is the sense of fearless expression. Sometimes I feel, you know, a lot of colleagues that I speak to in the architectural fraternity are so sort of scared. They're very scared about, with due respect, but they're scared about a number of factors, you know, client approvals or building code approvals and budgetary constraints. And all of these are sort of important. But for me, you know, art has that sort of fearless sense of democratized expression, democratic expression, not being bound by constraints. And I bring that into our architecture. And what I learned from architecture is the profession's enormous power to sort of impact society, right? And even to this day, this value, and this hybridization between art and architecture and what you can learn from these disciplines continues to form our studio's guiding light, you know. And as I explained earlier, the Bookworm was one, perhaps it was an example of this amazing sort of symbiotic cross-learning across disciplines process.
This has been enlightening and absolutely amazing, Nuru. Thank you so much for doing this and shedding so much light on this conversation.
Thank you. It was an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.